Before 1948, only women nurses could serve in the U.S. military during peacetime. All other women had to go home after war. From SDPB, today is Thursday, June 12th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, today is the anniversary of the Women's Armed Services Integration Act. Women have served in every American war and conflict since the American Revolution. Sometimes they disguised themselves as men to do so. But in 1948, President Harry Truman signed legislation that allowed women to serve permanently. That opened the door for career advancement in the armed services for more Americans. Today, we get to know a U.S. Army veteran from South Dakota. Lucy Middleton joined the Army in 1968 and served in Vietnam as a nurse. SDPB's Tim Davison and I met Middleton at the South Dakota Military Heritage Alliance in Sioux Falls. Her story is coming up after the news. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This week marks the anniversary of the Women's Armed Services Integration Act. The legislation was signed by President Harry Truman on June 12, 1948. It allowed women to permanently serve in the regular armed forces. Before 1948, of course, women had served in every American war and conflict in various roles. Sometimes they served openly. Sometimes they disguised themselves as men. But only women nurses could stay on in their military roles during peacetime. The Women Armed Services Integration Act changed that, opening the doors for career advancement in the military ranks for more Americans. SDPB's Tim Davison and I have been talking with South Dakota women veterans about their stories of military service. We'd like to bring you two of those stories this week. Today, we meet Lucy Middleton. She was a U.S. Army nurse in Vietnam who joined in 1968. What inspired you to join the Army?
I was married between my junior and senior year in college, and my husband was an ag teacher, went on a canoe trip in the boundary waters, and a storm came up that they hadn't predicted, and he and some of his students died in the cold water because it was the first part of June. So it was 10 days before our first anniversary, and a year later I was ready to change career focus, and looking at going and applying for jobs around Minnesota where I live just seemed overwhelming to me, but going halfway around the world didn't. And so I looked at what was available in Vietnam, and there was a ship in the Navy offshore, and there were 70 Air Force nurses and 700 Army nurses. And I said, with my advanced math skills, my best chance is the Army. So I went and got a guaranteed assignment to Vietnam.
What year was that?
1968. And after basic in San Antonio, I was assigned to the surgical research unit at Brook. That was my first year. And I was complaining because I wanted to go to Vietnam. And a friend who'd gotten her nursing education at Walter Reed said, you should back off a little. This is a plum assignment. People would pay to get it. And it was. It was research and burn treatment. And everybody was really excited about what they were doing. And the job was not so much just the physical health care, but the mental health care too. So that we had to keep people aware of the fact that they were going to live, not die. And that was a good lesson to learn.
But it was a good job. Where was that? Did you say Brook?
Mm-hmm. In San Antonio.
San Antonio. Is that an Army base or a hospital? What's Brook?
Brook Army Medical Center.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
What town in Minnesota are you from?
Well, I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay.
But my husband's family were in Truman, Minnesota, so that was called my home. But he and I had a house in Grand Meadow, Minnesota, south of Rochester.
So where did you were already a nurse in 1968. You had
yes.
already, were you in
yes.
school still? Or
no,
you,
no.
you were a nurse?
I'd been out for a year.
Okay. And what kind of nursing were you doing?
Well, I had wanted to do public health, but I thought if you're the public health nurse, you're the only one, and if you don't know it, nobody does. And so I didn't feel confident about that. So that first year I spent working in a 30-bed five-bed hospital in southern Minnesota. And little old ladies would pat my hand because they knew I'd been married before I got out of college. And they knew how much I wanted this baby. No baby. And so I would say thank you and go on about my day. But I started working with a public health nurse, and the state of Minnesota gave me a three-month training to be ready to be a public health nurse in Minnesota. And I was supposed to commit to 2 years after that of working in rural Minnesota in public health. And I asked him if I could postpone it because I had decided to join the Army and I would be back in a couple years. And they said, fine. So that's how I got there.
What you, so you know a lot about what's happening in Vietnam in 1968, and you still want to go in that direction. Why did you want to get to Vietnam so badly?
Because it was halfway around the world, and it would be interesting.
How much did grief at the loss of your husband play into that?
Not.
Adventure?
It was a beginning of the rest of my life. And it turned out to be one of the best decisions I made after 2.5 years in the Army, being surrounded by people who didn't feel sorry for me, didn't know they should. I kind of got over feeling sorry for me too.
Yeah.
And in Minnesota, they knew and they all just commiserated whether I was or not.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So how hard was it to join the Army then? Was that an easy thing to do?
Yeah, I went to some place to sign up, and they gave me a written guarantee that I would get to go to Vietnam. And, there are pictures in there of me saying, yes, I will do this. And I went and told my in-laws, and my mother-in-law says, not funny, Lucy. And I said, no, I mean it. She says, if you're serious, I'll support you. And they did. And I'm packing to go. And I'm very carefully sorting things to luggage, and it's getting to be time to be in Minneapolis for the plane. And my mother-in-law again says, you better hurry up or you're going to be late for your plane. And I said, just put everything somewhere. And she helped me finish packing. So
you get on the plane, and where do you fly to for any training, or was it, what's the first stop? San Antonio, Texas.
For basic, yeah. Okay. And then when I got back to South Dakota years later, and I was associating with other women veterans, and I found out that they did not have much respect for my basic training because they had calisthenics and all kinds of stuff. And we did a little marching, but other than that, it wasn't very military. It was like living in a dorm and taking workshops all day. And the two I remember the most was dental, and they talked about the dental service in Vietnam, and this little dentist with a crew cut comes in, and he's talking about how, you know, they have the GIs come in with their toothbrushes for their dental appointment. And I visualize a 300-pound Marine. The other one was evasion and escape, and that if you're ever captured, your assignment is to escape, but because you're medical, you're allowed to make promises and keep them. So you could say, if you let me go down there and take care of that guy, I promise to come back, and then you could do that. But if you did escape, you look at the people you escape with, and you figure out who does what. And when you get close to your own troops and they say, Lucy, go over there and tell them that we're here. And I said, you're the signal corps. You go tell them. So those are the things I learned in basic.
You learned how to escape if you had to. So then you go to Brooke. Mm-hmm. And the whole time you want to move on to Vietnam.
Well, yeah, but I was really happy where I was at.
Tell me about that experience at Brooke.
Had three sections. One was like the people who are past the original treatment and they're in a recovery phase. And then there's the ICU where people are getting very acute care. And then there's the cubicle. And the cubicle is a separate section of the ICU that's more intensive where people are really, really in a hazardous situation. And so we worked only 5 days a week, and the rest of the nurses in the hospital worked six because they said, your job is so intensive, you need more time off. But even in our time off, we socialized with the people we worked with. We called the patients the crispy critters. We commiserated with people about difficulties they had dealing with their job, whatever. But it was a good experience from that standpoint. The care of the patients was essential. It was also research. They were using sulfamilin cream. It's a white cream to treat the burns instead of silver, something that they'd used before that turned them black and ugly. And one of the doctors was doing research on why, when you had a bad burn, you didn't have much of your own skin to donate to the treatment. So they would start out by putting a graft on of either dog skin or cadaver skin. And then when that was on, the body would start trying to grab it, and then it'd say, whoo, this isn't you. And it would slough it off. And when the bed was ready, then they would take your own skin and put it on there. So there was a doctor doing research on how this worked. And many years later, I heard in the news that an artificial bioderm, they were calling it, had been created to use instead of cadaver and dog skin.
Wow.
But then you have to have a sense of humor about it in order to make people know they're not dying. So you hear one of the patients say, you know how you can tell when you've had the dog skin on long enough? No, how? It's when the carts go by and you bark at the wheels. And somebody else says, no, that's not it. It's when your ear itches and you can't get your foot up there. And you know you've done your job. That's where they're at. And one of my favorite memories is there were two young fellows from Puerto Rico. They were friends and had gone in together and gotten injured together. But one had been made blind at the time he was burned. And so he couldn't see. And he got a letter from his girlfriend. And his friend is not the best reader in the world. And he's trying to read this letter to him. And I said, I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. I know how to pronounce the words, but I don't know what they mean. So I could read that for you, and I'll still not know what I read. So you still have privacy. And they took me up on it. And that was a good experience.
So you read letters to him?
Yeah. And then some guy, you know, in burn treatment, you don't want to have things touching the burn. Clothes, for example. So the men would wear a towel around their waist, and the women would wear one tied around their neck that hung down in front, and the children went naked. And this one guy's in bed, and he's got a hand towel across his private area, and he's moaning and groaning and carrying on. It's just not the right size. And one of the civilian nurses went over and lifted it up and put it back down. She says, you're right, I'll be right back, and brought him a washcloth.
Were they civilian burn patients? Were they military burn patients?
A few were like family of people associated with the military. A woman driving down the street was burned when on a tank farm, one of the tanks exploded. And there are not basements in a lot of houses in Texas. And so these people were keeping the gas for their lawnmower in the little closet with the furnace. And a little girl opened the door, and it, and she was burned. So it varied.
Yeah. So did this prepare you for the kinds of things that you would see in Vietnam from an injury perspective, or was it totally different?
No, not from an injury, but from the interpersonal area that you could make yourself be part of the treatment.
Make yourself be part of the treatment.
Yeah, and we had in our area this huge, it looked like a outline of an angel that was a tank full of water, and they debrided burn wounds in that tank. And the people from the other unit where people were recovering had to come through there to go to the tank. And so our patients got to see that people get better, which was really, really good planning on the part of whoever designed that.
Yeah. So when do you, then you're there for about a year.
Exactly.
And then you're on to the next posting.
Right. Then I went to Vietnam. And we flew from Minneapolis, just a regular flight to like San Francisco or someplace, and took off from there and went through Hawaii. And it was like a, I don't know, total of a 10-hour flight. But when you arrived, we arrived at Long Bend Air Force Base, and I don't know how I got to Saigon to talk to this lady that helped me get my assignment, but anyway, I did that. And then they finally took us back to Long Bend, and we were assigned a place to sleep for the night, and that was the most important thing. It was so long since we had slept. Yeah. And you could hear the helicopters going in and out, but it didn't keep you awake. And they took us on a helicopter to Lykke.
To where? What's it called?
Lykke.
Lykke. Yeah.
And another nurse and I are waiting to go there. And while we're waiting, people would come by and say, "Where are you going?" And we'd say, "Well, that's second worst place you can go as a nurse. The worst is Tainan." And in Tainan, they had underground housing for the staff if they needed it, as well as above ground. And while we're waiting for our ride, her orders are changed, and she was sent to Tainan. So got to Lykke.
All right. Tell me about Lykke. What are your living accommodations like there before we get to the work
itself? It was a mash. The hospital wards were inflated Quonset hut, and they found out that they didn't stand up if something hit them, like a fragment of something, so they put metal beams inside to hold them up if anything happened. And the air had to be pumped in, so it was air conditioned to some extent. It was cooler than the rest of Lykke. We lived in tents. The enlisted people were, I think, 6 or 8 to a tent, and officers were only 4. And we had pathways around that were the metal that they used to make airport landing spots. And that would be the only place that's not muddy during the wet season. And it was wet and hot for 6 months, and then it was dry and hot for 6 months. During the wet season, if you did your laundry, and I brought along a little scrub board so I could do my laundry in the morning, and you'd hang it out. But you had to have it in by 2 o'clock, because then it was going to rain every day at 2 o'clock. And if you hung it out for only 3 days, they would be dry.
Oof. We'll have more with our conversation with Lucy Middleton. She's a U.S. Army nurse who served in Vietnam. She joined in 1968. More of her stories after the break. You're on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with U.S. Army veteran Lucy Middleton. Tell me about the patients. What kind of care are you giving?
It's very temporary. They're in and out. It's life-saving. And once they're able to transfer, they go to an evac hospital and free up our beds for more patients. So you don't have a long relationship with them. They're about 10 beds in a ward, and there's like a little nurse's station area at one end. At Christmas, I got a little bit of leave and went to Long Bend and found somebody who happened to be a Catholic priest who could help me get a Christmas tree to take back for my ward. And we decorated it with ribbon candy my brother had sent from the States. And it was that kind of improvisation all the way. Probably my best friend was the pharmacist and a couple of the other nurses, yeah. Especially the one that lived on my half of my tent. She was delightful. She was assigned as the nurse for the Christmas visit by the famous people. I don't even remember USO, who it was at the time, but that came, and they were older. Most of them were in their 70s and 60s, so being their nurse was a serious job. She did it. We heard about it, but she did it.
The celebrities had their own nurse.
Yeah.
And they needed her.
Yep. Yeah.
So are the injured soldiers coming in from you're seeing combat injuries?
Yeah, that too.
That too. What else?
Well, we also saw people who were not soldiers, like the lady who was walking along the highway and American GIs used her for target practice. And a young child who was injured during some kind of a raid and got separated from her parents. She's like 8 years old because she had to come to the hospital and they had to be evacuated somewhere. And when she's ready to be discharged, we made arrangements for a couple of the men officers from the hospital to take her and to find her parents. And she's not real helpful with identifying who they are. You know, their names are Vietnamese version of Mommy and Daddy. And so I'm using my rather meager Vietnamese skills. And I'm saying to her, now you're gonna ride with these people in the Jeep, say Jeep, and you're gonna go and look for your parents. And if you find them, you'll stay with them. And if you don't, you're gonna come back here and we'll go out again another day and try and find them. And I'm saying what I think is, and no crying. But I didn't get the right word and I said, and no laughing. And she cracked up. And that first day they took her out, and they found Mommy and Daddy. So that was the last of our visit with her. But people loved her so much. They wanted, GIs wanted to adopt her and send her home. And there was a couple in the kitchen who were Vietnamese but had no children, and they would have taken her on a bet. And she got her own Mommy and Daddy.
Yeah, no laughing.
With no laughing.
What happened to the woman who was shot by the soldiers?
She recovered. She got good care and she recovered.
Yeah.
But she did not get evacuated because she wasn't an Army person. So you had to know what was available in the neighborhood as far as Vietnamese facilities. And then she was sent to a Vietnamese facility, probably a civilian one.
Did that kind of behavior surprise you, that had happened to her?
You know, human beings don't always do the things they should, but they aren't all that surprising when they don't. You wished it hadn't. And when I would work in the emergency room and I'd hear one of the GIs, you know, chewing out some Vietnamese person who's lying in a cart saying, so how many Americans did you kill today? And, you know, and I never said anything to them because I didn't think the patient could understand it. And they were still giving very good care to that person. And I just balanced the two and said, the care counts.
The care counts.
And my goal in all of my encounters with the Vietnamese was to find out what their real name was, because in the ER they were given a name like George and Bruce.
And you wanted to know what their actual name was.
Yeah, and make sure that they knew we knew what their actual name was.
Yeah, human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Nursing.
Mm-hmm.
That's nursing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the doctors.
The doctors, they were very, very professional for the most part. I think they instigated the plan that the nurses should have walls in their tent so that each had a separate compartment. And we said, yeah, right. Well, be sure you don't make them go all the way to the ceiling or the floor because we need the air to circulate. So they didn't. One of the GIs out about somewhere, I don't know what his job was, but he thought he liked me a lot. And one of the doctors thought if I was going to date somebody, it should be somebody at the hospital. Well, I found out that guy was married, so I didn't have anything to do with him either. So that was easy. But for the most part, there was an ophthalmologist there who was very interested in the situation in Vietnam. And there are two kinds of people, for the most part. There were Vietnamese and there were Montagnards, were like tribal people. And the tribal people were not being offered a lot of education. And he identified somebody in the Mountaineer community near us and brought him in and trained him to do cataract surgery because it was a great need in his community, and nobody would fault him for doing it. They didn't have to have licenses or something. And so he left that gift to that group of people. Wow. We had people like that.
Yeah. How long were the days at work? What were your shifts like?
Basically 12 hours.
12 hours.
6 days at least.
Nonstop?
Pretty much. You got a three-day R&R every once in a while. I went to Bangkok once and to Hong Kong once and to Vung Tau, which was an in-country R&R, and was at the ocean. You're sitting on the beach and a woman comes by with pineapples and she's selling them, and you buy one and she grabs it by the thing and takes a machete and gets all the eyes out and takes that thing off and hands you the whole thing. A whole pineapple. And I went body surfing in the ocean with Australians. And whenever we had at the officers club, whenever there were Australians, once they got talking really fast, somebody would always stand up and say, "Is there an Australian interpreter in the house?" Because their version of English was significantly different than ours.
How old are you then in this time? You're 20.
23, maybe.
Yeah.
23, 24 in there.
Did you miss home? Did you miss South Dakota?
No. I got trained for that when I was young. I wanted to go to Girl Scout camp when I was in the fifth grade, and it cost $14 and some cents. And my parents said, "Well, you can go if you work for us at 10 cents an hour." So I earned it, and I went to camp. And my roommate was homesick, and I had no idea what homesick was. I could not believe it. You could always go home. It's getting to camp that's hard. So getting to Vietnam was a little harder. So, no. I wrote letters, and one time I tried out the phone that you could do connections, and it was sort of, well, yeah, right, kind of conversation. It wasn't.
Not very anything. Satisfying.
No.
Yeah. Do your parents farm? What did you do for them to work?
No, we lived in Sioux Falls, and so it was chores around the house.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
10 cents an hour.
In Vietnam, were you scared ever?
Mm-hmm.
What scared you?
One time we were driving, and there was a Lombretto in front of us, and this Vietnamese soldier with a gun got off, and he's yelling at people and walking around funny, and I thought, well, we better be really careful because he might not like us. Nothing ever happened. And I would get tired of being around the people I worked with every once in a while, and I would go out and sit on a hill and look at a river and read or whatever. And if a little child even came within my view, I would go back in because I didn't know who that child would tell that I was there. But that's not very... very scary. The closest we came to an injury was somebody set off a bombs down by our laundry in the middle of the night. Well, nobody's in the laundry in the middle of the night, so it didn't hurt anybody. That's as close as I got.
Did you have an awareness about what was happening at home during this time? Did you get news mm-hmm. about protests or politics or anything happening in elections in America?
I felt immune to all of that because I was out there. I couldn't pay attention well enough to vote. You knew about it, but you didn't know about it. And what happened to Vietnam returnees didn't happen to me, you know, because I came back and I put on my civilian clothes and I got on the airplane to come home and nobody knew. I was just a woman on an airplane. No big deal. So the first time it was ever really noticed was many years later when Dusty Johnson decided to honor Vietnam veterans, and I got to be honored by him.
So let's talk about being a woman veteran. Very easy to become invisible.
I was living in New Ulm, my first job, and I decided to join the VFW because I thought I was, because I was a veteran and it was foreign and it was a war. And I was told I couldn't join because I was a woman. I could join the auxiliary. I wasn't going to do that. And I asked why, and they said, well, because the real veteran spouses didn't want any women in the same organization with their husbands. And in my mind, I was saying, they didn't mind when I got him back home for you. But so I joined the American Legion. And all they did was drink, and I didn't like that. So I never joined anything again until I got here. And some women veterans started getting a bunch of us together. We called ourselves WOW Vets, Women Vets. And it was a very interesting experience. We really were supportive of each other, but it died during COVID and never came back.
Lucy Middleton is a veteran of the United States Army. She served as a nurse in Vietnam. We'll have more of her conversation after a short break. You're in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In honor of the anniversary of the Women's Armed Services Integration Act this week, we are bringing you some conversations with South Dakota women veterans. Let's get back to our conversation with Lucy Middleton, who served as a nurse in Vietnam with the U.S. Army. When did you leave Vietnam?
January of 71.
So you're there a year?
A year and a half.
A year and a half. Mm-hmm. What was the leaving like?
Well, it was time to go. I mean, you know, you just, it's what you do next. And I was happy to be going to see my in-laws again and get started back in civilian life.
So that's when you transitioned to civilian life, was after?
Again, yeah, back to civilian life.
Yeah, into nursing?
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. I started out in New Ulm. And I was the county nurse. Medicare had just started doing home health care, and they hadn't started theirs there. So I was responsible for that, among other things. We also did school nursing and other kinds of public health things that weren't necessarily nursing, but public health. And so we got home health care started, and one of the things we had to do was to train home health aides. We had a 5-day training program, and I gave them all a name tag on the first day and the second day. And the third day, a lady shows up and she says, my husband says, if he can't teach me my own name in 2 days, that I'm probably not qualified for this. So I stopped giving them name tags. It was a small group. So I learned a lot, but I did research with other places that had it and brought the information to a board, and together we decided how we were going to organize and what we were going to do and what we wouldn't do and that sort of thing. And then after that, I was in other areas. I went to Worthington for the Rock Nobles County. It was two counties, and they had been doing home health care. And there were two more counties that had not done it and were afraid. And so somebody organized that all four could work together. So we had a 4-county agency by the time I left, and we got home health care in there.
What did you bring home from Vietnam or from your military service that even if other people didn't know you were a veteran or didn't think about it, that you had learned, that you applied? Like, how did it change you?
Well, learning a language like Vietnamese is really tricky. And my third job at Vietnam was at a Vietnamese Army hospital. And so I really spent 2/3 of my time in Vietnam only with Vietnamese people, which was wonderful. And it's nice to have to understand somebody else's culture. And, you know, when I heard on the TV recently about somebody who had PTSD, and after like 30 years of not admitting he needed help, he finally went to the VA and got some help. But he also went back to Vietnam, and he had an interpreter there who helped him. And he's talking to the interpreter about the Vietnam War, and he says, what's the Vietnam War? And they talked about it. He says, oh, you mean the American War? And I had read a book while I was in Vietnam written by General Giap, who was the person in charge of the North Vietnamese Army. And what it basically said was that they were occupied by the French forever. And they finally got rid of them. And they really wanted Vietnam for the Vietnamese, but the only people who would work with them were the Chinese. And the people in North Vietnam, we would always say Uncle Ho and his 40 million red Chinese. The people in the South had us. But in fact, we had them. We wanted them to be a democracy, but we wanted them to do it our way. So they saw that as an American occupation almost. And that I already knew when I was there. So that was something I brought home with me, I guess. The big withdrawal was after I got home, but I could visualize it and say they finally got the country for themselves. And so the things you hear about Vietnam now, they're building automobiles for the international market. Vacation in Vietnam was a prize on a game show. And the pictures were fabulously interesting. They're doing good things with themselves. I worried about the Vietnamese who had worked with us because I felt that they would probably be discriminated against.
So your first, we talked about the first job that you had, and mm-hmm. then the third one was in a Vietnamese hospital?
When the evac hospital closed for the same reason, the GIs we supported were sent home, then I was in MACV, military assistance. Yeah. And they assigned me to the Vietnamese Army Hospital. And I carried a little tiny Vietnamese English dictionary in my pocket. Mm. And it helped a lot with communication because sometimes I didn't understand them or they didn't understand me, and we'd get it out and find the translation so we knew what we were talking about. And whenever they were concerned that they weren't understanding, they'd point at my pocket. So we knew what we had to do. But the typical ward had maybe 30 beds and 100 patients. You know, Vietnamese people are small. You can put more than one in a bed. And they didn't even have three sheets for every bed, so there wasn't one for the laundry and two for the bed. And they had two of these wards connected by a walkway. And in the whole hospital, 700-bed hospital, they had two trained nurses. One was the nurse anesthetist, and the other was the head nurse for the hospital. And all the rest were like nurses' aides or LPNs. All the medications were given in the daytime. The IVs were run in the daytime, but not at night. They would have a bottle of penicillin and a syringe and a needle, and they would give an injection to somebody, and then they take the same two and give it to the next person. Well, it kills bacteria, doesn't it? The operating room had windows on one whole wall, but people would sit on a hill outside and watch the surgery, and they didn't like that, so they hung curtains in there. So we talked about germ theory a lot, and I suggested they whitewash the windows instead of hanging curtains, and that was at least a little better. The hospital served tea and rice, and anything else you ate, your family had to prepare outside over a fire and bring to you. So it made me really pleased that back in my hospital, when I was in the same community, when we had 40 Vietnamese patients, that we provided tea and rice with every meal. The word for eating in Vietnamese is to eat rice. Even if you had hot dogs and potato chips, it was eat rice. So I saw to it that they always had those things, but they didn't have confidence at first that they would always get them. So there were boxes under the bed full of sand that were, if there was ever an emergency, the mattress would be the top, and this would protect you on one side, and between the two, you probably would be safe during whatever could happen. They would open it up and store food in there. Mm-hmm. So it was a problem with insects. But you understood after you've been in their hospital a while. That community was very medically oriented. It had a maternity hospital. It had the Vietnamese Army Hospital and a CIDG hospital, which was for Montagnards that worked with the military. It had a clinic that had 12 beds that would take civilian tribal people. And there was a leprosarium somewhere in the neighborhood, and there were two nurses who did an itinerant route providing medication to people with leprosy. And they treated leprosy like we treat mental illness. You know, it's okay to have it, but if you're identified as having it, you're shunned. So they were getting volunteer supplies of vitamins and supplements like that from doctors in the States. And they would, for example, be in a certain village on a certain day, and they would give the patients that many vitamins so it would run out on the day that you were supposed to come back. And if you lived 3 days from the site, then when there were three left, you started walking. That was the calendar.
Wow.
They were very creative that way. So I learned a lot about things that we would never encounter here.
Yeah. Did that change when you came home then? And I asked this question because it was true for my father. Mm-hmm. He would often bring up the things he had learned from the Vietnamese people about resourcefulness, about thrift, about creativity. And he would often give us those lessons that there was another way to do, and he had seen some of those ways. Did you bring any of those lessons back, and how did it feel to be in America where it was a very different culture?
I just do things my own way, no matter where I am. But I became friends with a Vietnamese nurse, one of the two nurses at that hospital. And so I went to their house for a meal, and they had what they call banana bread. And it was bananas dipped in a batter and deep fat fried. So then we invited them back to our house, and we had banana bread, our kind. So we could trade, you know, things like that.
If a young person, especially a nurse, but a young woman in South Dakota today was thinking about a career in the Army, what advice would you give her?
Well, you got to do what fits with your life, you know. A friend of mine was a member of the Army when she was a nursing student. That's how she paid for nursing school. Well, I couldn't do that, even though I had no idea where I was going to get the money to go to school. I couldn't commit to two more years of something at that young age, you know. Well, life changed in a year.
Yeah.
So, not so much that, more about making friends with people who are not the same as you, I guess.
Yeah. Were you able to keep in touch with anyone?
No. Yeah. And that's sad.
Yeah. It's not possible then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was difficult because shortly after that, you know, all of America left Vietnam.
Yeah. What do you wish you knew about their lives now?
I'd like to visit again. Mm-hmm. I think that it would be exciting to see modern-day Vietnam, because I think it's what they dreamed of before we were there and never could get.
What do you think that you would want people in South Dakota to know about their women veterans that come back and go to work and do their jobs and have experiences overseas that maybe they don't understand?
One of my friends who's a woman veteran, among other things, worked at the Pentagon. So I used to know a lady who was a general. Women in the military are more and more able to do anything anybody else can do.
If you were to talk to an elementary school, a classroom, and they're studying the American Revolution and things like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, what do you want kids to understand about what it means to be an American?
All through, from the standpoint of a woman, all through history, including the American Revolution, women have been involved. Women were with the army in the revolution. Women were involved in the Civil War. Women have been involved in all of those things. And they didn't seek to get credit, and so didn't get credit, you know. But some of us got credit even though we didn't seek it. We were just doing what we wanted to do. And it's important to know that there are better ways probably to solve problems than wars. And it's too bad that wars have been needed in the past to accomplish things that maybe couldn't have been done any other way. I think World War II is probably the biggest example of that, and the Civil War certainly was too. But
do you believe peace is possible?
Oh, I think it's possible. Probable, no. There's a big industrial military reason for going to war, and that's that it's how you sell the product. Capitalism is a good thing, except when it's a bad thing. I think most of the things that are important to me are anecdotes. You know, they're not...
I like anecdotes.
They're not world-shaking things, you know. Yeah. It's like the story about the two guys, one who was blind and the other who couldn't read. Well, you know, that's anecdotal. But those are the things that are important to me over time. I was in the officers' club, and I'm talking to this Vietnamese gal who's working there, and we're talking about all the things I like in Vietnam. And she says, you really like Vietnam? I said, yeah, I really like Vietnam. Then why are you leaving? And I said, well, if you went somewhere else, you would want to go home. And eventually I want to go home. Oh, yeah, that made sense to her.
Yeah.
So it was those kinds of things that, I don't know, they warmed my heart. I think it's good to make sure that your life includes people whose life experience is different than your own, because that broadens your array of people that you can care about. You know, I'm 79 years old, and out of the 79 years with two husbands, I was only married for 5 years. So you can have a lot of relationships with a lot of people outside of traditional life experiences.
This week marks the anniversary of the Women's Armed Services Integration Act. We will have a conversation with another South Dakota military veteran tomorrow on In the Moment. You've been listening to Lucy Middleton, U.S. Army. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Special thanks to SDPB's Tim Davison for his work on these interviews. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.